This audio is provided without charge by Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, which reserves all rights. Please visit givewts.com to learn how you can support Westminster or contact communications at wts.edu for more information.
John Fox, one of the great historians of his day, a great gatherer of documents. The work that he produced went through numerous recensions, even during his own day, as we shall see. Took on a life of its own after he died, possibly. If you go to a Christian bookstore this afternoon and pick up a copy of Fox's Acts and Monuments, or Fox's Book of Martyrs, you may find a chapter on Jim Elliot in it. Well, Jim Elliot wasn't around in the 16th century. What you see is a book that has taken on a life of its own, where people keep adding bits to it for, I think, polemical or pious reasons, as we shall see. Fox himself, his dates were 1516 to 1587. He was educated at Oxford, but nobody's perfect, I guess. Under Mary, he was one of those who fled to Strasbourg. He also spent time with John Knox in Frankfurt on the Main. Fox and Knox in Strasbourg sounds like a Reformation Dr. Seuss novel. Gets even better because Fox and Knox have a battle with Cox in Frankfurt on the Main. So yeah, Fox, Knox, and Cox. We'll do that when we talk about Puritanism more. Returned in 1559, was ordained as a priest in the Church of England in 1560 by Bishop Grindal of London. Grindal will go on to be an Archbishop of Canterbury and fall out with the Queen. His great work is Fox's Acts and Monuments. Martyrology is very important in the Reformation. One of the questions that the Reformers will be faced with repeatedly is, so where were you guys before the Reformation? One of the ways of answering that is to point to the Trail of Blood. It's not a particularly good way of answering it, but because all those on the Trail of Blood are by definition dead, you could sort of appropriate them for your own cause. So one way of establishing the historical credibility of Protestantism is to trace back the line of suffering, because as we all know, the true church is always persecuted. Actually, the false church is quite often persecuted as well, so it can be kind of problematic. But for the sake of argument, we set that to one side and we just trace the line of blood back from the English Reformation, ultimately to the Acts of the Apostles, establishing the validity of the English Reformers and the non-novelty of the Protestant position. The individual narratives in Fox's Book of Martyrs, Fox's Acts and Monuments, generally fairly stylized. There is quite a bit of personal detail. If you were to read the account of John Hooper and compare it, say, to the second century apostolic father's account of Polycarp, one would notice there's a lot more human interest. Hooper is working with more material. He's working in a more modern idiom. But by and large, the plots are fairly straightforward. You've got good guys versus bad guys, and the bad guys generally win. But the good guys are heroic martyrs and are therefore decent sort of fellows who are worth following anyway. The book is not just a martyrology. It also draws on late medieval books of the so-called Ars Moriendi, the art of dying, books that were designed to explain to you how to die a good death. And Fox's Book of Martyrs not only establishing the credibility of Protestantism, it's also presenting exemplars of good deaths. It's a standard technique in Christian history to present martyrs as those who embody the idea of a good death. We even get hints of it in John Bunyan with the death of... Is it faithful at the stake? Bunyan, of course, was, when Bunyan was in prison, one of the few books that he ever had access to was Fox's Acts and Monuments. Bunyan is profoundly influenced by John Fox. You cannot, I mean, one of the things amusing about things about Pilgrim's Progress is it's, these days, it's one of those sort of beloved Christian classics that everybody likes. You know, you've got Catholic friends who like Pilgrim's Progress, and you think, have you ever read it? What about that bit where, you know, where the Pope is in his cave, is in the cave? He can't get out, but he sits in his cave gnawing on the bones of the martyrs. Do you remember that scene in Pilgrim's Progress? It's not a very ecumenical scene really. But it is driven by Bunyan's understanding of Catholicism, which is drawn pretty much exclusively from his reading of Fox's Acts and Monuments. So, John Fox, then, the history of his work. Fox produces two early martyrologies in Latin before he gets his Great Commission. The Commentarii Rerum, the Commentary of Things, or the Account of Things, 1554, and the Rerum in Ecclesia Gestarum, of Things Done in the Church, of 1559. These works focus really on the persecution of Lollards. The underlying his agenda is to show that the new Protestants do have precursors, but they're fairly brief works focused on the suffering of the Lollards. When he returns to England, he comes to the attention of Grindal. And either Grindal or the great printer, English printer, John Day, persuade Fox to concentrate on producing an English martyrology, a martyrology that focuses particularly on English suffering. And so Fox sets about this, and in 1563 produces the first edition of the Acts and Monuments, in which he praises Elizabeth as a modern-day Constantine. So there is a clear political sycophantic purpose here as well. Remember, of course, that this is the era in which England is starting to use the language of empire in its political discourse. It won't have a significant empire for a little while, but it's starting to think of itself as an empire. And the, you know, when you're going to compare, if you're going to compare your monarch to a Roman emperor, you want to choose a good one, and they don't come better than Constantine. John Knox compares Charles V to Nero. Bad choice. Gets himself expelled from Frankfurt almost overnight for that particular sermon illustration. 1570, the book has massively expanded. Somebody should do, I don't know if it's been done, somebody should do a PhD dissertation on the editions of Fox's Book of Martyrs from the 16th to the 19th century, because it would be... I'm told that friends of mine have told me that I need to watch Ken Burns' documentaries on baseball, because you know, the history of baseball, it's like a history of America in the last 100 years. You know, a lot of the social issues, race, et cetera, they bubble up in baseball in significant ways. I just find the sport so utterly boring. I've just got to take their word on it. There's no way I can sit through even a half-hour documentary on baseball, let alone a multi-episode one. Fox's Book of Martyrs, though, is a bit like that, in that it's almost a thermometer of English Protestant polemics from the 16th through to the 19th century. 1570, the project has massively expanded. Now, Fox takes the story back to the Acts of the Apostles. So he establishes a lineage, if you like, between Stephen and Cranmer, one might say. A single coherent narrative that places the English church in the context of the apostles. Catholicism is resurgent by 1570. It's not defeated. It's pushing back. And it appears that part of what is driving Fox is a need to establish the cosmic importance of what's going on in England. That England, if you like, the English Reformation, is the continuing Acts of the Apostles. And various things, therefore, shape this next edition of Fox's work. Elizabeth, for example, is definitively excommunicated by the church in 1570. The cultural impact of the 1570 edition is massive. The Privy Council, the elite cabinet around the Queen, basically the real policy makers, executive policy makers in England, order that Fox's Book of Martyrs be set up in every cathedral church and in the homes of cathedral chapter clergy. Just think of the significance of that. 1571, there are three books that by law have to be in every cathedral. The Bible, the Book of Common Prayer, and the Acts and Monuments of John Fox. That's an important book. That's an important book. Imagine also the symbolism of that. You know, the Bible, it's God's Word. The Book of Common Prayer rises, it's a liturgy that rises out of God's Word. Fox's Acts and Monuments, where does that fit into it? It's the history of God's people. It's the official history of God's people. So, if you want to understand, if you want to understand English Protestantism, you have to understand the King James Version of the Bible, you have to understand the Book of Common Prayer, and you have to understand Fox's Acts and Monuments. And this book retained its grip on the English imagination right the way down to the 19th century. There's a small Reformed Baptist church in my home village where I go when I'm at home. And the secretary there is a friend of many, many decades now. He's a much older gentleman, but a friend of many decades. My little book, Reformation Yesterday, Today and Tomorrow, actually dedicated to him. And he tells this story of a preacher that would come to the chapel when he was small. His father was the minister. He grew up, he spent all his life in this chapel. A minister who would come to the chapel as a guest preacher. And he would always read, he would read a passage from the Bible, and he would read a passage from Fox's Acts and Monuments in the service on a Sunday. And my friend told me how it was just terrifying, because he would always pick, you know, the goriest passage there where the Catholics were as wicked as they could be, you know, and Hooper's arm, as it does, you know, falls off because it's burned through the flesh when he's still alive, something like that. And his father also had, at the top of the stairway in the manse, a great picture of Latimer and Ridley being led to the stake, you know, and that famous statement of Latimer to Ridley, you know, be of good cheer, Master Ridley. And he used to sit as a child at the top of the stairs and stare at this picture, and it still grips his imagination. And that may be an odd story for somebody of his generation. It's beginning to die away. But for Christianity in England prior to 1900, that would not have been a unique or unprecedented story. Fox grips the imagination. The book continues to live after the death of Fox. And in 1610, the famous Bulkeley edition is produced. Bulkeley is significant because Bulkeley adds stuff on the French wars of religion. So Bulkeley is bringing it up to date. What Bulkeley does that is significant and important, though, significant and important for what will happen after, is that Bulkeley makes it very clear where Fox ends and the appendix begin, if you like. So it's very clear what the original Foxian text is and what the new editions are. It's 1632. The 1632 edition changes all that. 1632, the politics of the English Church has dramatically changed. Catholicism is no longer a major threat, but there are threats. The struggle within the Church is between Arminianism and the Reformed. Now, when I use Arminianism in the English context in the 1630s, I'm not so much thinking of the thought of Jacob Arminius. The great Arminians of the 1630s didn't really think in those terms. Arminianism was a polemical term used by the more Puritan members of the Church of England to demonize those of a more high church bent. It's ritualism that's really becoming the issue in the 1630s. And it's exacerbating the Puritan struggles that have been going on since Hooper first raised his complaint about the use of the surplice in his consecration. Fox's Book of Acts and Monuments at this point becomes a Puritan text. First of all, there is included a life of Fox in the work, which details Fox's own biography with a special emphasis upon things such as his alliance with John Knox, his objection to vestments. Fox's life is appropriated for the Puritan cause of the 1630s. The work also expands, so much material is added to it that it expands from 2 volumes to 3. And critically, no distinction is now made between what Fox wrote and the stuff that comes later. It's all of a piece. You know, I often think we underestimate as Christians, we often underestimate the physicality of the word. If I can explain that. I was speaking in Boston a couple of weeks ago with a delightful fellow, Tabiti Anwabili, an African-American pastor, now is pastoring at Baptist Church in the Cayman Islands. Very entertaining person. Wow, very, very good preacher. But I was amused when he at his first sermon, he stood up and he said, if you'd all switch on your Bibles and scroll down to. And then laughed. I thought, yeah, that's the world we live in, isn't it? We all, you know, everybody just opens up their iPods, iPads, and we no longer have the, you know, the material Bible. I was thinking, but I still, you know, if I'm traveling, sometimes I'll just take my iPad and have my Bible, but I still like to, there's an aesthetic to holding a Bible. I do a lot of work with an early English books online, but nothing can beat sitting in the rare books room in Cambridge University Library with a book in front of you and smelling the mustiness of the pages and feeling them and touching, you know, what William Perkins touched. There's something about it. But I think there's also something more significant. You know, a Bible that's bound in front of you, you're able to see things in relation to each other. You're able to flip back and forward. There are things you can do that actually shape the way you think about the Bible. I have a sort of, I don't have a photographic memory, but I tend to have quite a pictorial memory when it comes to pages. I remember whereabouts, I remember that quotation, it was at the bottom left-hand side of a page, like four-fifths of the way through or something like that. That's how I think about how to find stuff in books. We lose something when we lose the physicality of the printed page. I also think that the way Bibles are printed and laid out also affects the way we think. The Scofield Bible, I'm going to be needlessly offensive to any dispensationalists here. So if you're dispensationalist, I apologize in advance, but it beggars belief to me that anyone believes the Scofield Bible. It strikes me as arrant nonsense at a whole host of points. I remember when I first became a Christian, hearing somebody preach on Revelation and going up to after the service and said, what can I read on this that'll help me to understand the book of Revelation? And the person said, there's only one book you can read on this, that the late great planet Earth. I went to the local Christian bookstore, and it's a sign of the quality of British evangelicalism. Even though we're small, there's a certain quality to it. That when I asked the person behind the counter if they'd got a copy of the book, they'd never even heard of it. It was fantastic. They had to order it for me. I may be the man responsible for bringing Hal Lindsey's book into Britain. I don't know. In which case, I need to repent 10 times over. But I got to about page 5, and I was thinking, this is insane. This is absolutely insane. I can't possibly believe it. Then I come to America in 1996, and I switch on the television. I'm watching this news show, the Jack Van Impe Show, which starts off, and it seems to be sort of sane. And then suddenly it's Hal Lindsey. And they take, I don't know if you've ever seen the Jack Van Impe Show. It's very demeaning to women because his wife is portrayed as this absolute idiot. I mean, it's a grim thing to watch. And he has this ridiculous, his friend has this ridiculous toupee. You can't take a man in a toupee, seriously. But I'll give you a taste of the Jack Van Impe Show. There was this, somebody wrote in and said they'd heard that NASA was suppressing the fact that there was a giant black cube heading towards Earth. And could this be the new heavens and the new Earth, you know, the heavenly Jerusalem? To which my answer would be, No, because that's completely bonkers. That's absolutely... Jack Van Impey's answer is no, because events have not yet sufficiently unfolded for the New Jerusalem to be arriving. Which is incoherent within Jack Van Impey's own framework, because the key question is how fast is it travelling at that point? He can't possibly make a categorical statement that it isn't. That's the kind of lunacy you have. Why does this lunacy, why does it have such a grip, particularly on the American evangelical imagination? I think one of the reasons is, I've forgotten my one reason. No, I haven't. I was thinking, there are no reasons, but if I was to hazard a guess, the Scofield Bible. The Scofield Bible, which prints the explanatory notes on the same page as the biblical text. And that's a powerful juxtaposition. That is a very powerful juxtaposition. It doesn't equate the Scofield commentary with the biblical text, but it doesn't really force them apart as they should be either. Now, there are many studies. That's why if you've got a study Bible, it's important, one, that you don't use it all the time, and two, that you are self-consciously aware of what the actual physical presentation on the page can do to the way you think about the print on the page. By expanding this work from two volumes to three, I didn't think I'd ever get Jack Van Impey into a lecture on Fox's Book of Martyrs. You wouldn't get that at Duke University, would you, Ian Jin? They've never even heard you. Only at Westminster do you have Jack Van Impey blended with serious Reformation scholarship. And I can't remember how I did it now. So that was a one-off. But by moving from two volumes to three, and by eliminating the difference between Fox's stuff and the new stuff, yeah, everybody knows that the martyrs of the early 17th century on the continent, they weren't put in there by Fox. Everybody knows that the recent stuff that's added in 1632 about the persecution of Puritans within the Church of England, Fox didn't understand the stuff. They know that at an intellectual level, but it's seeping unconsciously into the system that this is all on a par. So the edition of 1632, very, very important. Sorry, 1632 and 1641, those two editions. It's actually 1641 that adds the life of Fox. It is 1632 that blends the new and the old. So, sorry, there's two separate editions there. The book continues to have a life, though, after the death of Fox. 19th century. Catholic emancipation. It's often, Catholics are very quick to tell you how they were disenfranchised in England constitutionally from the 17th century onwards. But what is often forgotten is that Baptists and Presbyterians were also, and Quakers were also disenfranchised. Basically the same legislation that marginalized Catholicism marginalized nonconformists as well. Incidentally, that's one of my reasons why I'm not convinced by Weber's thesis on Protestantism. I don't think it's Protestantism that makes the difference. I think it's being marginalized that makes the difference. That's why the Protestants are so good at industry in the 19th century in England. It's not Protestants in general. It's nonconformist Protestants who make money in England in the 19th century. Catholic emancipation in the 1630s, in the 1830s. The rise of the Oxford movement under Pusey, Newman and Keble. Newman's conversion to Rome, 1845. There's a lot going on. Catholic, Irish immigration, the potato famine, doesn't just send the Irish west to America, it sends them east to Scotland and to England as well. Irish immigrants are Catholic immigrants. The fear of Catholicism rises rapidly in England in the 19th century. And guess what? Fox's Book of Martyrs finds itself produced in a nice, spanking new edition as part of the anti-Catholic atmosphere, fueling the anti-Catholic atmosphere in England in the 19th century. So Fox's Book of Fox's Acts and Monuments, I think it's a fascinating book. It has a history all of its own. I hope, I'm not sure they'll do it. I know that Bruce Gordon at Yale is doing the biography of Calvin's Institutes. But at Princeton University, it would be fascinating if they commissioned in their biography of the Great Book Series a biography of Fox's acts and monuments, because it really is a great example of how polemic and propaganda lives on and gets transformed and redeployed long after the original circumstances which called forth its production and long after its original author has well and truly died. Any questions on the life of the book before we come to look at some of the pictures in the book? Yeah. Sorry? Not aware so. Not aware so. There were other martyrologies produced on the continent, particularly Anabaptists. The Anabaptists were good at producing martyrologies, mainly because Anabaptists did not have a massive theology, but they did have an impeccable pedigree of being persecuted and executed. The Mirror of the Martyrs. If you go to Lancaster County and go into some of the older, you know, if you were to meet with some of the old Amish families, or what are the, not the, the Amish, the Mennonites. If you were to go to a Mennonite, traditional Mennonite family, they'd probably have a copy of the Mirror of the Martyrs because it's very important for their religious identity. Catholicism in the English mind, because of Fox's Book of Martyrs, Catholicism, it isn't like Lutheranism. It isn't like an alternative Protestantism. Catholicism is a murderous, subversive, foreign power which desires nothing short of the conquest of the United Kingdom and our subjugation to the church. Catholic, anti-Catholic prejudice is so alien by and large to us now, even as Protestants, it's hard to understand. But as I say, even in 1960 in America, it was an electoral issue. The irony is that in 2004 you have another JFK running on the Democratic ticket, and his problem is he's a Catholic, but he's not a good enough Catholic, and that's why he's going to lose the Protestant evangelical vote, because he's compromised on abortion, doesn't uphold Catholic teaching on abortion. The other great, any other questions on the book? All right, let's see if I can get this thing to work. The other great thing about Fox's Book of Martyrs is the pictures. Let me get them up on the screen. Oh yeah, that kind of works. Wow. I might even grow to like technology to some extent. Oh, I can, isn't that clever? I can even adjust the size on it. Wow. They'll be allowing you to link computers up to these things next. So, okay. Oh, I thought that was a pointer. The one bit of technology I do like are those little red pointers. Because you do damage to people, you know, if you aim them. Okay, I haven't got a pointer, but I'll use my... Oh, wow. Oh, yes, I like that. Let me stand up. I feel more comfortable somehow standing over this side for some strange psychological... First edition tells a story. Remember, it's Elizabeth I on the throne, but her father is Henry VIII. And what you don't want to do as a Protestant is diss Henry VIII. We know a lot of bad stuff went on relative to Protestants during that time. We know that Henry VIII was no Protestant. And we know that some of the people in the book that Fox is going to include in the book perished under Henry VIII. But we want Henry himself to come out of it pretty well, because it is his daughter who's on the throne, and blood runs a whole lot thicker than water, generally speaking. So we have Henry on the throne, a sort of quasi-imperial figure, and you'll notice he holds the sword, he's the head of state, he's the civil magistrate, and Cranmer is handing him the Bible. He's also the supreme governor of the church as well. So the English Reformation settlement is epitomized in the picture of Henry VIII there. And we have a number of characters hanging around here. We got Cranmer, the great hero of the English Reformation, there. And we have Cromwell, the architect of the legislation, just behind Cranmer. Not sure that this person is identified. Here, we've got old Bishop Fisher. He sort of perished the same time as Thomas More in the 1530s. And we have, well, who's this character down here? It's the Pope. Triple crown fallen off his head under the feet of the king. Traditional symbol of being placed and being subjugated. We have all of these sort of characters around here. Notice they're even balder than I'm becoming. And for me, it's merely part of a natural process. For these men, actually, I think probably part of a fall, actually, but natural process once we assume the fall exists. Though I also think mullets are part of the fall as well. Anyway, and I'd rather be bald than have a mullet. These are confessed men, confessionally committed to having their heads, the tops of their heads shaved. They are monks, so they are bad guys. And they're trying to get the poor old Pope out from under Henry's feet. And we've got this chap over here who's actually holding a mule or a horse ready for a quick getaway for the Pope. So it's kind of a nice, fun story being told there. The Pope is really not doing well at all at that particular moment in time. The next frontispiece, I think from the second edition, this is my favorite. This is my favorite, both because it tells a story. It blends medieval and Reformation elements, and it contains a conundrum, which I don't think even the designer of the frontispiece realized. So the first thing to notice is it's actually, this is a bit of Reformation propaganda, but it's a very medieval idiom. It's a medieval doom. That tradition of medieval painting where Christ sits atop a rainbow and the good go to heaven and the damned get cast into hell. So it's wonderful to have, I think that there's probably a certain amount of sense of humor here. The frontispiece designer is grabbing hold of something distinctively medieval and Catholic and putting it to Protestant use. Like all medieval dooms like this, it should really be read from the bottom upwards. It's telling you the story of life from the bottom upwards. We have at the bottom two different worship services. You'll notice here, we have the Protestant service. You've got the preacher, pretty prominent. You have God's name over here. You have a group of people worshiping God in his word. It's not a picture. It's a word. And we have these godly ladies down here. Notice the men tend to stand. The women would bring stools to church. Godly ladies down here. And if you look carefully, if you've got the picture on your computers or whatever, if you look very carefully, these godly ladies have open their Bibles. They're reading their Bibles. It's a scene of comparative peace and piety. On the other side, we have the alternative. We have the Catholic service. Hey, I quite like pointing it. I might start using it Obeds more. It's kind of the same strange sense of power you get pointing this thing around. Over here, we have a Catholic service. We got this chap here. Goodness knows what he's saying, but he's pointing over towards a wee shrine. And there's a group of people going out on a kind of pilgrimage to a shrine here. They're not worshipping God according to his word. They're doing obeisance to an image, to an idol. And we have our counterpoint group of ladies down here with their rosary beads. They've not got Bibles, they've got rosaries. And this lady here is fast asleep. It's a lovely touch. She's fallen asleep. The whole thing is so utterly boring. As opposed to sermons, of course, they're always absolutely fascinating and riveting. this lady's fallen asleep. So we have a definite picture here of, you've got piety here, rooted in the Word and the reading of the Bible. Over here you have superstition, idolatrous pilgrimages to images. And, you know, you can tell how pious these people are. One of these ladies is fast asleep, even as she works her way through her rosary beads. We move up a stage. Here we have a group of men chained to stakes, looking heavenward, looking up towards Jesus on the rainbow. The flames lick their tied bodies, but they are blasting their trumpets to honor the Lord. Notice they all point upwards. They're definitely going towards the Lord here. The alternative is what's going on over here. We have a priest. Notice he's got the hallmark tonsure, just in case you hadn't guessed who he was. He's dressed in these fancy robes. His back is to the congregation. And he's holding up the host. Everything. And they're kneeling here in idolatrous worship of this. Everything that Protestantism would abominate is symbolized in this man here. And then you have his little acolytes around him. And their trumpets aren't focused up here, where the Lord reigns. They're focused here, where, ho, 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 so say, the Lord has come down and stuck himself in a piece of bread and is being worshipped there. So you have the contrast. Again, godly worship, godless idolatry. Godly martyrdom for the faith, ridiculous, idolatrous exercise. We get then up a stage further to the final stage. Here we have the martyrs translated to heaven. They carry palm branches. They blast their trumpets again, pointing at the Lord above them. And they wear the crowns that have been prepared for them as martyrs. Their end is glorious. Their suffering lasts but for a moment. And their end is glorious. Over here, we have a bunch of people being dragged downwards towards hell. And notice they have the same hairdos as the men here and the men, and they were on the other picture, of course, weren't they? They have the tonsures. These monastic charlatans are destined for hell. It's a great picture. Where's the conundrum? Where does this picture, in the correct sense of the word, deconstruct itself? Yeah. That's sort of odd, but not what I'm thinking of. I'm thinking of something even more profound than that. It's a picture being put to what purpose? There's a cross, it's a picture being put to the purpose of what? Images are no guide to truth. It's an image telling you that you can't trust images. That's what I like about it. So do we believe it or don't we? Yeah, I love the fact that here we have Protestantism, the word-based religion, using a picture to tell you that pictures are nothing you can base your religion or your view of the world upon. It's nice. I think it connects, of course, that, you know, we're dealing with, you know, you're an illiterate person. Part of the power of Fox's Acts and Monuments, and many clergy bought their own copy. Only chapter clergy had to have a copy, but the records indicate many clergy bought their own copy. You go and visit the pastor, and you're thumbing through his book. The pictures will grip your imagination. I remember as a child, before I could read, I didn't come from a Christian family, but my grandmother gave me an old copy of Pilgrim's Progress. And I couldn't read, but I still have in my mind the pictures of Christian in the valley of the shadow of death, Christian fighting Apollyon, and faithful dying at the stake. Those pictures grip my imagination. Couldn't read, but they sent me a powerful figure, and I can still remember the picture of the Pope gnawing. He was gnawing on a thigh bone. I remember which bone it was he was gnawing on in the edition. Pictures are powerful. And I think one cannot understand English anti-Catholicism of the 19th century and before that without understanding Fox's Acts and Monuments. And one cannot understand the power of Fox's Acts and Monuments simply by looking at the text. You've got to look at the pictures as well. It was the pictures that taught people more than anything else. So I love that this bit down here, don't trust pictures, is great, because of all the great picture books ever produced in history, Fox's Acts and Monuments has to be one of the most influential out there. Just give you some, we've done that one. A couple of illustrations that I also gave you to give you examples from different editions. Again, we have here, I think there's a martyrdom going on in the background, just a nice little touch there through the open window. And here you have this little girl, Rose Allens, who's gone off to fetch some water for her mother who's dying. And this dastardly man, Edward Tyrrell, is interrogating her, presumably to get information on the Protestantism of her parents, because indeed they are Protestants, notice. The woman is dying, but the man has not called for the priest to pronounce to give final unction or anything. He's kneeling, praying for his beloved wife, that she will pass comfortably as possible into the next world. But again, you know, look, this is a powerful picture. Here we have this thug picking on this little girl. And you might say, well, the people know it's just a woodcut. It may not have happened that way. He's burning her hand. He's holding a flame under her hand to interrogate. I mean, a really nice, you know, lovely chap. So I'm sure his mother was very proud of him that day. We live in an era of Photoshop. People can Photoshop all kinds of stuff that never happened, and somebody out there will believe it. Somebody out there thinks there's no smoke without fire. I don't see it would be any different with a woodcut. And indeed, we'll come to a woodcut in a minute that haunted Edmund Barnett to the day he died. Here, you're asking about were women martyred, Lauren. Here we have, I picked this one for that specific reason. Here we have a woman being burned at the stake. And the particularly sort of gruesome, sort of pornographic bit of this is that she's heavily pregnant and her stomach is burned open and the baby is flying out of the stomach into the flames. That's a powerful picture. You know, okay, we live in a computer age. We're used to much, you know, more dramatic, more realistic pictures. But that is a powerful emotional image. That picture is worth 1,000 words. That is powerful. When somebody says to you Roman Catholicism, and the first thing that flashes into your mind is that picture, it's going to shape how you think about the Roman Catholic Church. So it's a powerful, very powerful picture. And then my favorite one. Oh, by the way, we do have a sort of equivalent today. How many of you have ever seen Chick Tracts? Classics. They're worth it. Go to chick.com on the internet. Classic cartoon tracts. My favorite is the one against Halloween. They always end with this sort of blood and gore. I mean, I couldn't possibly give that track. At the end of the Halloween one, Mr. Pumpkinhead bursts through the window wielding a chainsaw to behead the children. It's really quite terrifying. An appointment, I think. It's really quite terrifying. But what's interesting about Chick Tracts is, I was thinking of them, they're a kind of Protestant pornography. Chick has a rather unhealthy interest in the torture, it seems to me, of women in his tracts, which is sort of part of the rather gruesome allure of them, I guess, but also says something pretty bad about the pathology of the man doing them. Anyway, this is where we get to the classic pornographic shot from Fox's Book of Martyrs. I remember some years ago I was going to give a version of this lecture, and as I'm walking across to the lecture, the director of development, as then was, introduces me to these two old ladies. And he says, these ladies are up from Texas. They're donors to the seminary. I'd like them to sit in on your class today. And I'm thinking, it's my pornography in the Reformation class. They can't sit in on it, so I had to completely ad-lib an entirely different lecture for an hour while they were there so that we didn't go into liquidation at the end of the year. This picture is particularly gruesome, and you can see what's going on. Edmund Bonner is getting some pleasure out of flogging the naked backside of a Protestant in his own back garden, and he's just doing it for fun, essentially. And to add to the horrendousness of the situation, the man here is almost certainly a Protestant. He's making a Protestant be involved in this torture because the man is covering his eyes. He finds it unbearable. But you've got a couple of wicked Catholic clerics here. Notice the hats hanging around in the background just to assure you that what's going on has the sanction of the church. This picture is interesting because it haunted Bonner for the rest of his life. I think there is no evidence whatsoever that Bonner ever personally tortured a single Protestant. But they stuck it in Fox's Book of Martyrs. And there are records. Bonner had people knocking on his door after Elizabeth came to the throne. Bonner was continually harassed by people calling around to ask him, is it true that you used to beat naked Protestants in your back garden? So I put it up here, first of all, as an example of the kind of, you know, Protestantism will, as Catholicism did, stoop to pornography in its pursuit of its cause at points in the Reformation. It's not wholesome at all. Secondly, if we're inclined today to be skeptical and say, yeah, but it's a woodcut, would never have happened. No, people only make woodcuts about things that actually happen. There's no smoke without fire. This was believed by people in the Reformation. So Fox's Acts and Monuments is absolutely critical for the perception of what goes on and the understanding of what went on under Mary's reign, for demonizing Catholicism and really culturally securing Protestantism in the English mind. Even today, Roman Catholic, I don't think they've changed the rule, Roman Catholic cannot succeed to the throne in England. If Prince Charles converted to Catholicism, he could not be king. If he married a Roman Catholic, I think he would have to relinquish his claim to the throne. And that anti-Catholicism goes back to the 16th century and was peculiarly profound in England because of the way the Marian persecutions were presented in popular culture.
Thank you for listening. For more information about how you can help Westminster continue to provide content like this without charge, please visit givewts.com or email us at communications@wts.edu.